I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The cover story of The Atlantic this month is the product of a year-long investigation. Are we any safer? Since 9/11, the United States has spent $1 trillion to protect the homeland. The new security state is vast and growing. The author of the piece is Stephen Brill. He is the founder of Journalism Online, a company designed to create a business model for journalism to flourish online. He's a feature writer for The New Yorker, The New York Times, and Time Magazine. He founded the Yale Journalism Initiative, which recruits and trains journalists. That's good. And he is the author of After, How America Confronted the September 12 Era and the Teamsters. And so we are delighted to have him with us. In this piece, he reminds us 15 years ago, this Sunday, actually, September 11, 19 terrorists using four jetliners as guided missiles killed 2,977 people and enveloped the country in fear. The story in The Atlantic, and it's a lengthy piece, is the story of the first 15 years of how we have dealt with that newfound fear, how we have confronted, sometimes heroically and sometimes irrationally, the mechanics, the politics, and the psychic challenges of the September 12 era. Stephen, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks so much for this article. It's just so good. It's just on all fronts. You've really done your work, haven't you?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You start, and I never heard the story of President Obama, where he was on September 11th, and when he went outside and looked at the Sears Tower. I hadn't heard that story about him.
Yeah, as he recalls, he was in his state senate office. He was a state senator at the time in downtown Chicago. And he went outside, really, there were people gathered outside to look at the Sears Tower, which, as you know, is the major skyscraper in Chicago, hearing that there might be a security issue there, and sort of a lot of people gathered just sort of watching the building. And then he went home that night and recalls that he and the future First Lady were worried about the new and newly dangerous world their two daughters were going to grow up in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we all shared that worry that day, didn't we? It was so hard.
We did.
Yeah. You will remind us of, and you don't want to be reminded of some of this, but where we were on September 10, and you have to play this what if, and you don't want to do that. It's amazing how many of the security agencies on September 10th weren't sharing information, didn't have a lot of resources, and all that happened on September 12th. Remind us of some of the things that were going on with the Federal Aviation Administration, with the Justice Department, with the Attorney General, then John Ashcroft, on September 10th.
Well, it's really kind of amazing in retrospect. 15 years ago, September 10th, for example, the FBI had a meeting with the then Attorney General Ashcroft and asked him for more money for anti-terrorism efforts, and they were turned down. At the same time, other officials of the FBI briefed Congress, also on September 10th, and declared that the major domestic security threat to the United States on that day were animal rights activists.
Oh, my gosh.
At the time, the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, was responsible for the security of our airliners, and they had a no-fly list, a watch list of 12 people. Now, at the same time, the CIA and the FBI had terrorist threat lists of hundreds, if not thousands, of people. And in fact, at that time, September 10th, the FBI and the CIA and the FAA had decided that they were going to publish a new list to the airlines, because the airlines were responsible for security, that would be more than the 11 people who were on the list. And the list was sitting in the outbox at the FAA, ready to be distributed to the airlines, but there was disagreement over whether it should have the letterhead of the FBI
or
the FAA. And at least two of the people who got on those planes, who were terrorists, were on those lists. we were in a completely different mindset. You know, the President of the United States, you'll recall, on the morning of September 11th, was reading to school children in Florida. The Attorney General on the morning of September 11th was in a plane on his way to read to school children in Milwaukee as part of a Bush administration, you know, child literacy effort.
Mm-hmm.
So we were not really focused, not for lack of knowledge. There had been a presidential commission that had reported in a third and final report in January or February of 2001 that there was an imminent threat of a terrorist attack from abroad that would kill hundreds of people. Had a big press conference. This was a commission led by former Senators Hart and Rudman, had a big press conference to publish the report, and there was scant notice of it in the newspapers the next day.
Hmm.
Nobody was paying attention.
Mm-hmm. Today, 15 years later, you write, all U.S. security agencies share the same watch lists and threat databases, which are constantly updated, so we have connected many of the dots.
Yes, we have. And whereas on the morning of September 11th, as I said, the airlines were in charge of airport security and they had very low-wage, you know, private people at the security checkpoints who allowed people with knives to get on planes because they didn't want to slow down the security process. As we all know, and as sometimes often frustrated, the security process at the airport, while still, you know, highly criticized and controversial, is very different. The one thing that the hijackers were able to do, which is gain entrance to the cockpits of those airliners so they could hijack them and fly them into the Pentagon and the Trade Center, they can't do anymore because the cockpits are all secured with, you know, metal doors that are impervious to that kind of an attack. So we've done a good job in a lot of respects. At the ports, we have all kinds of new technology that detects radiological materials, detects, can scan for weapons in containers. We've quadrupled the number of Border Patrol agents on the southern border. And as you know, if you go into any office building in pretty much any city in the United States, at least you have to go through the motions of presenting some form of identification. You know, we're obviously very much more security conscious, but we haven't plugged all the holes. And as I point out in the article, we can't plug all the holes.
Right.
And one of our challenges is getting, dare I say it, used to the idea that that President Bush's promise of never again is just not realistic, as we found out in San Bernardino and in Orlando and other places.
Yeah. Well, particularly when you have access to the kinds of machine-grade guns that we have in this country. You go to
a
gun show or online, so how can you say never again when you've got that in place here?
Right. The one thing that we haven't done, the threat has evolved, as the security experts like to say, from the kind of orchestrated, big, spectacular attacks involving, you know, many people across, you know, many countries, plotting an attack here. We're much better at connecting those dots, at surveilling, at interrupting communications, at looking at those kinds of threats. But what we can't deal with is the new threat of so-called lone wolves, or people in smaller groups, or even people here in the United States alone who are inspired by something they see online. And the one thing we could do to mitigate that threat is the one thing we refuse to do, which is stop being the only country in the world where anybody, including a terrorist, has easy access to military assault weapons.
Mm-hmm. You write, Stephen, that a lot of good has happened. There's been a large flow of federal funds to cities all over the country, and they've plugged security gaps. But you also write that when the adrenaline subsided, our after September 12 mindset turned to contractors and consultants and academics and bureaucrats. All you needed was a proposal that had something to do with Homeland Security, and the money flowed in, and boy, did the money flow in.
Right. I paint a picture, for example, of Richard Clark, who was the the lead anti-terror expert in the White House on September 10th, who was the one person who was very focused on Al-Qaeda and the threat, and everybody accused him of, you know, having his hair on fire and being, you know, perpetually in a state of panic. By the time I interview him several months ago for this article, he says, you know, even I think some of it has gone too far, and he tells the story of a few years after 9/11, he has a country house in Virginia, and he burned a bagel one day, and his fire alarm went off, and 2 minutes later, this giant attack-style fire engine showed up, this giant piece of equipment to put out his bagel.
And his bagel.
He found out, he said, "My God, what is that thing?" And it was this $300,000 piece of equipment that the rural county where he lives had gotten as part of a Homeland Security grant. And there are thousands of instances like that. And, you know, basically everybody sort of, you know, kind of beltway mentality latched on to the new big thing, which was Homeland Security. Every college and university worth its salt started offering courses in Homeland Security, seeking research grant money for Homeland Security. And, of course, all the usual suspect, you know, government contractors went in and promised the government that they had technology that could do all these wonderful things. We spent billions of dollars on the southern border, a big contract to Boeing, which installed towers with sensors and radar and cameras. And the stuff had to be ripped out a year later or 2 years later because the alarms that went off were when mosquitoes flew.
Oh, my gosh.
And there were dozens of instances of that. And on the other hand, there were dozens of instances of money very well spent. The FBI and local police agencies got together and created joint terrorism task forces, which really connect the dots at a local level and have had a lot of success dealing with plots. We've done all kinds of Homeland Security drills that were financed by the federal government, all kinds of emergency preparedness drills. There was one, for example, done in Boston a few months before the Marathon bombing that plotted out so carefully and so precisely how ambulances and other first responders would be deployed and how the patients they picked up would be distributed in the hospitals in and around Boston, that miraculously nobody who didn't die at the horrible scene of the Marathon bombing died, you know, once they got into an ambulance.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of good, there's a lot of bad, which sort of, you know, typifies a lot about America. But there was a lot of greed and a lot of ingenuity, a lot of people doing things way beyond the call of duty, and a lot of people taking advantage.
Yeah. And some of the people were just smart right from the get-go. The guy who was, where was he, in New Jersey? McCabe, is that his name? Who was looking
right
at the containers and thinking, oh my gosh, all these containers are here and there might be bombs on them.
Right. He was on the port in Elizabeth, New Jersey, which I think is the second largest freight port in the United States after Long Beach in L.A., and he immediately segregated the containers that had come in from, you know, countries that were, you know, more suspect than other countries, such as North Africa and the Middle East, and gave them a different kind of inspection than he had usually been giving them. The customs people at the ports until 9/11 were basically focused on, you know, finding drugs. His people were experts in finding, you know, heroin hidden in you know, avocados, but now they had to change their strategy and change their methods, and they did so pretty quickly. And meantime, in Washington, the Bush administration negotiated with governments around the world, and we had our own port inspectors were able to be deployed in ports all across the world so they could at least begin to inspect containers headed for the United States before they got to the United States.
Mm-hmm. You also highlight where we may be vulnerable, and some of this is a little frightening. An eye-opening report highlighting a continuing gap, a biological attack, something that could happen.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, those of us who remember what was going on 15 years ago in September, remember that right after the 9/11 attacks, there were the anthrax attacks, mm-hmm. where someone mailed envelopes of anthrax to several media companies and several congressional offices. And a bunch of people died, a lot more people got very sick, and there was panic around the country. And bioterror became sort of the it cause. I mean, everybody was concerned about it. It made huge headlines. Three New York Times reporters fortuitously had written a book called Germs, which was published, I think, the week of 9/11, as it happened, about the threat of a bioterror attack, and that, you know, that shot to the top of the bestseller lists, and it was all in the news. We spent billions of dollars deploying BioWatch sensors, as they were called, to 36 different metropolitan areas around the country, and these were machines that took samples of the air and tested them for a half a dozen different potential pathogens. The problem was that they really didn't work, and no one really knew if they worked. And even if they worked, it would take 36 hours from when they got the air sample to when they would know that something was amiss, by mm-hmm. which time, you know, if you were walking through Grand Central Station in New York, where, you know, where one of these machines was set up, 36 hours later, you'd be long gone, mm-hmm. and, you know, you'd be dispersed all around the country. Well, you know, 15 years later, we still have the same bad equipment being used and maintained with the same samples collected every 36 hours around the country at the tune of $80 million a year, which is over $1 billion. Everybody still concedes that the stuff probably doesn't work, and yet, no, you know, the second generation or the third generation of that technology has never been developed because it just became, you know, not a headline and not an interest. So I watched a congressional hearing, I think last March, where the members of Congress, Democrats and Republicans, were complaining to an official from the Department of Homeland Security, you know, what's going on with this? Why haven't we fixed this? Why haven't we developed better technology? And he said, well, we're working on it. We're working on it. It's probably 3 to 8 years away.
Oh, no.
Well, if that was still in the headlines, you know, we would have fixed that in 6 months.
Exactly. Maybe you have. I didn't know this at all. You talk about the number of committees and subcommittees and all of these organizations that are looking at the Department of Homeland Security. Maybe they have too many overseers.
Well, it's actually kind of ridiculous. The one clear, unambiguous example of mismanagement and turf consciousness and selfishness and dysfunction when it comes to Homeland Security is Congress. When the Pentagon was reorganized in the 1940s, you know, it used to be a separate Department of the Army, Navy, and Air Force. When it was reorganized into the Department of Defense, the various committees and subcommittees in Congress that oversaw those departments consolidated into a defense committee, an appropriations committee, and an authorization committee on each side, the Senate and the House. So a total of four committees. The Department of Homeland Security, when it was formed in 2002, out of 22 different agencies, the Transportation Committee, for example, a subcommittee oversaw the Coast Guard, a subcommittee of the Treasury Committee oversaw the Customs Bureau, another committee oversaw Secret Service. None of them gave up jurisdiction.
Mm.
So you now have dozens of committees holding hundreds of hearings a year and basically occupying the executives of this department, which even without this problem has its own management problems, but and basically it is chaos. And when you ask any member of Congress, they concede, well, you know, none of us wants to give up turf. Homeland Security is really sexy. I'm a chairman of a subcommittee. Why would I give up my responsibilities to somebody else? So the one place where it's clear that politicians are behaving in a short-sighted, selfish manner that threatens national security is when it comes to Congress, Republicans and Democrats, reorganizing themselves into a really rational and cogent system of oversight.
Well, imagine the time it must take for all those committees to have hearings, huh?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I added it up. It's thousands of hours. And, you know, and people in Washington, if you're a government official and you have a congressional hearing, you treat it like, you know, it's the Academy Awards. You do, you know, 8 hours of rehearsal for every hour that you're going to testify. So basically all these people, the only thing they do is prepare for congressional testimony.
Stephen Brill is our guest this hour. We're going to welcome phone calls for him. He has a very lengthy piece, an important piece in The Atlantic. It's the cover story, Are We Any Safer? It's been 15 years now, amazingly, since 9/11 this coming Sunday. We have spent, he reminds us, $1 trillion to protect the homeland. The new security state is vast and it is growing. He looks at where we are safer now and where we are still vulnerable. We'll look at lone wolf attacks and look more at bioterrorism and other subjects with Stephen. Stephen is right now the founder of Journalism Online, a company. This is a good idea, designed to create a new and viable business model for journalism to flourish online. He is a feature writer for The New Yorker, for The New York Times Magazine, and for Time Magazine, and he's done a lot of other things as well. And so he's here this hour. Here's how you reach us. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. The Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We are on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. And we welcome your phone calls, and we'll start taking many of them in just a moment. And we also wanted to mention that Stephen is also author of America's Bitter Pill, Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. And he is the author of another book about 9/11 that was published shortly after 9/11. That is how America confronted the September 12 era. All right, to you momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, lots of phone calls coming in for Stephen Brill, and let's start with Peter in Madison. Hi, Peter.
Yes, hi.
Hi, Peter.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, a little better now, yes.
Okay, good, good, good. Well, I'm an immigrant here. I came about 17 years ago, and what struck me at that time that I was talking to somebody at the bus stop. That was around, I cannot tell with precision whether it was before 9/11 or just shortly after. That person was about 20 years old and came from Somalia. And as I was talking, he spoke some English. He said that America, as he put it, is kaput. And I understand what it means because I lived in Germany too. And I said, why do you say those things? And he said, you know, he mentioned that Allah is great, and I understand Arabic quite a bit because I took course in Libyan embassy how to understand some words in Arabic. He was a fresh refugee to this country, and that was his stance on reality. And I said, aren't you grateful that you are here, not starving somewhere in Somalia? No, he wasn't. He wasn't. And I remember that because I pretty much prior to that, I lived in France. And at the time, as I was taking the subway train in Paris, the bombs were flying and taking people's legs off. I was about 30 minutes away from that train that actually did that thing. Those people were from the Middle East. I don't know if you are familiar with Tapie's department show. That
yeah, Peter, I just need to ask where you're going with this.
I'm going with that your guest is talking about technical protection of this country. There's no technical and hardware protection or Secret Services. This is not going to work. That's why I wanted to talk on your previous program, because I wanted to say that if anybody votes for Hillary, you will have 500,000 refugees that are not
affected. All right, what about the, you cover the lone wolf. What about the people among us? And you write about this, that we're much more protected against some organization, Al-Qaeda carrying out some massive attack as they did in New York City and in Pennsylvania and in Washington. Mm-hmm. What about the people that he met? What about the people who may be here, who were born in America, the lone wolf scenario that we're dealing with now?
Well, he's not describing anybody that I know of who's committed a terrorist act, and there's zero evidence that any of the Syrian refugees are any kind of threat. In fact, they're the most vetted people in this country. Certainly much more, you know, well-vetted than Timothy McVeigh was, or than the people who did the San Bernardino attack, or than the guy who did the Orlando attack. I didn't hear a question there. I heard a statement, and I basically disagree with the statement.
Yeah. What about the people, though? Talk more about the people, because I didn't realize that there are some agencies now that are looking online, that are there are some campaigns of say something if you hear something. What's going on
right
in that realm?
Well, there's a certain irony to it, which is we're spending a lot of time and effort, as we should, trying to find so-called lone wolves, people who are, might be sitting in their parents' basement online and inspired by ISIS and can go get an assault weapon and do all kinds of damage. And I guess we have to, and that's a good thing, but you have to ask yourself, well, why weren't we spending that time looking for people who might be sitting in their parents' basements online and inspired by something else other than, other than ISIS to go get an assault weapon, and shoot up Sandy Hook?
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Kenneth in Janesville. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. There was a hour and a half long program several months ago about this on TV, and one of the things I remember is over 1,000 offices spread out through the country that are open, that have been opened in strip malls and so forth, and have the Homeland Security people working in them. And there's a building in Washington, D.C. that was built, and to hide it, they went very deep. It has more office space than the Pentagon, and this building has been filled with people, more people than there are in the Pentagon.
Stephen?
That's not reality.
That's not true. What about the number of contractors? I've heard that there are huge parts of Washington that are devoted to Homeland Security. Is there?
Sure. There,
yeah.
I mean, every government contractor worth its salt, whether it's Boeing or Lockheed or Raytheon or Northrop Grumman, Booz Allen, you name it, has lots of Homeland Security contracts and lots of salesmen who are in an only in the beltway mentality called capture teams, always out there looking for Homeland Security contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And those take the form of the kind of sensors you can put on a border to big data technology that can sweep the internet and social media looking for, telltale signs. And some of it works and a lot of it doesn't.
So we're awarding the contracts based on a promise?
The way a contract will work is the government will put out something called an RFP, or request for proposal. And the request for proposal may say, as in the example of the technology on the southern border, we need technology that will detect, you know, people trying to cross the border, do this, do this, do this, do that. And historically, the problem is that contractors will promise everything. They'll cite their, you know, their prior experience doing all this stuff, even if that experience turned out not to have worked. And they'll compete with each other on the basis of promises. And then very often the promises just don't get kept.
Mm-hmm. There are some...
You know, and sometimes there's good reason for that. I mean, to go back to the first such instance I was talking about, when the anthrax attack happened, if there were contractors who could promise that they had these biosensor detectors that could detect this stuff and provide an alarm system and a warning, and the only thing we knew as a country was we were sort of naked to this kind of an attack, it's pretty understandable to spend the money and say, okay, go ahead and install it, mm-hmm. and ask questions later. And the questions we asked later was, how come it doesn't work?
Hmm. We also, though, you remind us early in the article that when it came to those initial mailings and the initial scare, we had no idea what to do, did we?
No. And that's the, and so, you know, if I am a government official and I can see this threat, and in fact the threat has materialized, and the country's in a panic, I'm in a panic, and someone says, I have this equipment you can install and it'll work, you're tempted to, you know, not to say, as the Government Accountability Office might say, you know, the auditors might say, well, let's test it for a year or two in one place and see if it works. You might say, well, you know, let's just get it out there, and, you know, we can't risk waiting a year or two. This happened yesterday. We've got to do something.
Mm-hmm. The prize for the most wasteful post 9/11 initiative, arguably, you write, would go to FirstNet. What's FirstNet?
FirstNet.
FirstNet. It's your favorite?
Well, it's sort of a metaphor, though a very big one, for a lot of what's happened, which is there's a tragedy, there's a problem, there's a need, there's an inclination to want to respond, and there are government contractors who want to make money. And there's a lot of politics involved in it, and so here's what happens. In this case, a lot of our listeners will remember that one of the great tragedies of 9/11 were the hundreds of firemen who were lost in the towers, particularly the second tower,
yes.
Which collapsed while they were in it trying to rescue people. And there was a lot of controversy that at the time over, you know, why weren't they told to evacuate? Why weren't they told that the first tower had collapsed and theirs was going to collapse and they better get out of there? And the story was, well, their radios didn't work. Well, that was true. But the reason their radios didn't work actually was because they were very high up in these, you know, much, you know, fortified buildings. And the radios had relay signals built into various floors of the World Trade Center, so the radios would work. But the relays melted because, you know, as we all know, the building was on fire. It was a terrible fire. So the relays didn't work, so they did not get the message. That sort of morphed into a kind of urban myth that the police couldn't communicate with the firefighters. And if you had something called interoperability, which is the ability of different first responders arriving on the scene with different radios, if they could talk to each other, we'd all be much safer and they'd be better off, which is true. So an effort began then to solve the so-called interoperability problem, and that morphed into, 15 years later, a quasi-independent government agency that has let out a contract that's going to be anywhere from, it's going to cost anywhere from $5 billion to $47 billion to create a completely separate telecommunications network, radio network, a cellular network for all the first responders in the country and in the territories, including Hawaii and American Samoa and you name it, you know, from Alaska to Key West. Everyone, everywhere, will be able to communicate with their own, you know, special device on a separate communications bandwidth, so that if a firefighter from Key West ends up at the scene of an emergency with a policeman from Washington, D.C., they'll be able to talk to each other on their radios if they're in a forest fire in Idaho. Now, there are a lot of reasons that makes no sense. The first one is that we now all have interoperability. If you have a Verizon smartphone and I have an AT&T smartphone, I can talk to you. That wasn't necessarily the case. People weren't walking around with smartphones in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Second, there was also a problem that the regular cell phone lines were jammed in an emergency. As we all know, it was hard to make a cell call.
Yes.
You know, during 9/11 or even during Hurricane Sandy here in New York, because everybody was trying to do it at the same time. That problem has now been solved by giving first responders a code so that they can get priority with their cell service.
Mm-hmm.
So having, again, the whole separately dedicated system, a whole new system, a whole new telecommunications system across the entire United States, that's not necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Then the other bells and whistles this thing is going to have would be you'd be able to transmit pictures and data, you know, the floor plans of a building. If there was an emergency in a building, you could transmit all that data over this special system. Well, we can all now do that with our cell phones. You'd be able to, you know, allow a group of, let's say, 200 people to have exclusive access to something. We can all now do that through, you know, Facebook groups or other different kinds of designated groups. So the basically the tech problems have been solved, and this has become this sort of, you know, snowball rolling down the hill. It's way behind schedule, as evidenced by the fact that I'm talking about it 15 years
exactly.
later.
Exactly.
And yet it keeps going. It's got this big office out in Virginia somewhere. It's about to let out another contract. They say they're going to make their money back by selling this new service to police departments. Well, guess what? New York has bought interoperable equipment for its police and firefighters, and they've given them all smartphones and iPads, so they don't need it. Los Angeles doesn't need it. There may be some rural police departments that need it, but they're not going to buy it at the prices these guys are going to charge, because you're going to have a separate piece of equipment for it.
Well, Stephen, we have all these committees and subcommittees in Congress. Surely they must be investigating this, aren't they?
Well, the subcommittees that oversee it love it, because all the lobbyists and the businesses that are going to make money from it support the members of those subcommittees.
Mm. Okay. Let's go to Mel in Madison. Hi, Mel.
Hello, Kathleen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question for Mr. Bill related to reevaluation of the Second Amendment. I think that the current interpretation of the Second Amendment accounts for a lot of our problem. And I think what most people don't understand is that the Constitution was written as intended to be a living document that would change as time changed. And when it was written, arms, the force of arms, which was guaranteed to the public, was written in for several reasons. One, people hunted to make a living to get food. They hunted, however horribly we have to perceive this, because they were surrounded by hostile Native Americans, and they had just liberated themselves by force of arms which were comparable to the force of arms of a British army. The idea that individual Americans with assault weapons could ever defend themselves against an unjust government is an absolute fantasy. There is no way to protect yourself against Black Hawk helicopters in the event that our government turned against our people. And what we need to do is reevaluate, I think, the Second Amendment, because that addresses both of the issues I hear you discussing, both the lone wolf terrorist attacker and the lone wolf aggressor responsible for things like Sandy Hook.
Stephen.
Well, let me say, I agree with you that the Constitution is a living document, and I agree with everything you've said, but you don't even have to go that far. Justice Scalia's interpretation of the Second Amendment, and Justice Scalia, as you know, was the Constitution is not a living document. The Constitution was meant to be interpreted the way it was written. Even Justice Scalia said in his ruling on the so-called Heller case, which declared an absolute ban on guns in the District of Columbia unconstitutional, even Justice Scalia said that the way he reads the Second Amendment, you can regulate certain kinds of weapons. For example, I don't think any of us would agree, and I'd love to hear the NRA weigh in on this, that people should be able to drive a bazooka, you know, down Fifth Avenue. You know, drive an Abrams tank with a bazooka down Fifth Avenue. An assault weapon is a military weapon. There is nothing in any constitutional decision, as written by the most conservative Supreme Court justices, that says you couldn't ban an assault weapon or limit the magazine content to 8 rounds instead of, you know, 32 rounds. But the best example would probably be armor-piercing bullets. The National Rifle Association is even against banning armor-piercing bullets. Now, armor-piercing bullets are the bullets that are used to go through police officers' bulletproof vests. There is no one hunting who needs an armor-piercing bullet to kill a deer. And yet, a terrorist can go into a gun store and buy assault rifles and buy armor-piercing bullets. And there is no interpretation of the Constitution, even Justice Scalia's interpretation, that allows that. The reason we don't have those laws is not because of the Second Amendment. It's because of the National Rifle Association and the fact, you know, that politicians in Wisconsin and everywhere else, you know, too many of them, are afraid of the National Rifle Association.
Stephen Brill is our guest this hour. His piece is the cover story of The Atlantic. It's culmination of a year-long investigation. Since 9/11, the U.S. has spent $1 trillion to protect the homeland. The new security state is vast and growing. And the question is, are we any safer? More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655. Mel, thank you for your call. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. One area we haven't yet talked about, Stephen, and let's do it right now before we go back to phone calls. You talk about the president, President Obama, failing to finish the job of securing radiological material in hospitals and industrial facilities or to crack down on the threats from bioweapons and toxic chemicals. What needs to be done?
Well, what this to me is the major threat, looming threat beyond lone wolves, and that is that something called a dirty bomb. And a dirty bomb is sort of the essence of terrorism in the sense that it's meant to scare us to a degree far beyond the harm it can actually do. What a dirty bomb is it's taking radiological materials that'll give off some radiation. The kind of material you can get in a hospital where they're treating cancer patients, at some industrial facilities where they're irradiating germs out of food products or testing the ground for oil and testing logs for how thick they are. There are all kinds of radiological materials used industrially and medically all around the United States in thousands of facilities. What I explain in the article is that stuff is really not secured very well at all. In some instances, not secured in any way. It's easy to obtain. If you took some of that material, not a lot of it, and mixed it with a conventional bomb, such as TNT, and set it off in a crowded area, a few people would be killed, but when the police show up and test the area, they will see that the radiation contamination has been enhanced to a degree equal possibly to a so-called Superfund site, which sounds really scary.
Mm-hmm.
But as I explain in the article, that might mean, for example, if you set one of these dirty bombs off in downtown Washington, that the area would produce additional radiological contamination such that one, there'd be an extra cancer death for every 10,000 people living there, which also sounds scary until you do the math and you realize that in a city of 500,000 people, that would be 50 extra deaths over, let's say, a decade. And 50 deaths, I could deal with that if I went through one office building in Washington and got people to quit smoking. However, the panic and the headlines that would ensue would be such that you might say, well, this is like a Superfund site. We need to evacuate all of that area, which, again, could be a huge chunk of downtown Washington, let's say, and knock down all the buildings because the cement is where that that radiation will reside, knock down all the buildings and rebuild everything at a cost of billions of dollars and lots of dislocation over 2, 3, 5, or 10 years. So what I suggest has to happen are two things. First, we have to do much more to secure that material. And second, and most important, and this won't cost a penny, is the president should have, both Presidents Bush and President Obama, a real discussion with the American people about this in an education campaign to explain before something like this happens, not after, that this is meant to scare us and it's not the real threat that it sounds like. And if you try to do that after the bomb goes off, no one's going to believe you.
And if you do that before the bomb goes off, you're maybe making people more fearful, right?
Well, that is the problem. And you're risking a political attack from people like a Donald Trump who are saying, well, why don't we just stop all this stuff instead of preparing us for this? Stop it. You're being weak. You're conceding defeat. Mm-hmm. And with that in mind, what really scares me is that, again, these bombs are not hard to make. And every expert I talked to in the months I was doing this article, when I said, well, what's the one thing that hasn't happened that you're surprised hasn't happened? They all said a dirty bomb. And what I worry about is that in September or October, you could have the ultimate October surprise, which is ISIS or a terrorist organization, all of which would love for someone like a Donald Trump to be president because he is constantly declaring war on Islam. And that's what they want us to do. And President Bush and President Obama have refused to take that bait. But someone like Trump does that every day, that they would really facilitate a panic that could maybe result in his election by detonating a device like this and scaring everybody. Mm.
Carol, we have about a minute left in Green Bay. Hi, Carol.
Hi, I just want to say a word. You know, I was working in downtown Chicago when 9/11 happened, and just outside of the Loop, and we were evacuated quickly that day. After that, that's the most important thing, and I think we're still safer after this because of the human element, and that is that after that, when you heard a fire alarm, when you heard something happen, you got out. Prior to that, it was like, we think nothing's happening. They drilled us, they showed us where the stairwells were, they showed us the number of steps to get to here and there. I felt safer. Don't think we weren't all nervous getting on the train that afternoon. But we're better off because we know what to look for now. I feel that way.
Thanks, now, Carol.
Yes, I agree completely. And again, though, what politicians worry about is that if they emphasize drills and stuff like that, they'll be attacked. And I can show you instances in this article of politicians criticizing President Obama for emphasizing that kind of resilience and preparation, saying, well, you're just throwing in the towel. Or you're scaring people. Mm-hmm. And it's a necessary thing for political leaders to do. It's a necessary a thing for employers to do, for people who run venues, is to take those precautions and communicate with people beforehand.
Stephen, thank you so much for being with us and for the article.
Happy to do
for
it.
All the work. Thanks.
Thank you.
Stephen Brill, it's the cover story of The Atlantic. Are we safer? Since 9/11, the U.S. has spent $1 trillion to protect the homeland. The new security state is vast and growing. Stephen spent a year on this report, and it's well worth everybody's attention. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and to KP for on-air production work here in Milwaukee.